Today is September 9th, 2024, and this is Karen Brewster in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm on the phone with Mike Zeidlich.
That's correct.
Zeidlich, who is on the other end of the telephone in Idaho, and this is for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. And Mike, you can tell me exactly where in Idaho you are.
I'm about 5 miles north of Coeur d'Alene.
Okay, and what's the name of the community?
It's Hayden, Idaho.
Okay, great. I sent you some sort of general overview questions in advance, so I'm just going to kind of walk us through this. Related to your work as the trail administrator with BLM for the Iditarod Trail, and I guess other functions you had at BLM that may have related. So before we get into that, just, you know, a little bit about yourself so people know who they're listening to and, you know, when you were born, growing up, education, things like that.
Well, let's see. I was born in Oregon in 1953, and I grew up in western Oregon, and we moved to northern Virginia, the Washington, D.C. metro area. And I went to high school in Northern Virginia and in Montana. Two high schools, one in Virginia and one in Montana, and then I went to the University of Montana and got a degree in forest management from U of M.
All right. And so how did you end up, when did you graduate from University of Montana?
In 1975.
Okay. And so when did you come to Alaska?
Well, a couple times, actually. I worked on the Tongass National Forest in 1975 as a timber sale administrator and spent a year there, and then came back south and worked for the state of Montana, the Forest Service in various locations, and Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I want to say you were doing forestry work at that point still?
Yeah, forestry, fire management. I worked as a short time as a fire researcher for the Northern Forest Fire Lab.
Okay.
And as an outdoor recreation planner as well.
Okay. And so what got you back to Alaska?
Well, I went to work for BLM in Colorado in 1983 as an outdoor recreation planner and wilderness special wilderness coordinator. And in 92, I transferred to Anchorage to be the Iditarod coordinator, one of three outdoor recreation planners at the Anchorage District.
Okay. Tell me about what that job entailed.
A little bit of everything. We had three outdoor recreation planners there in the district at the time. I was the lead planner. We had one planner whose primary responsibilities were the contracting and construction of the Campbell Creek Science Center at the Anchorage Campbell Track.
Mm-hmm, right.
The other outdoor rec planner was primarily permitting. He did most of the special recreation permits for guides, outfitters, and various other commercial activities that were recreation related, and then I was the coordinator of that, plus the Iditarod, plus forestry and a bunch of other tasks. All of us had collateral duties and other aspects.
Okay, so it wasn't two part-time jobs. It was three people doing three part-time things to do.
Well,
one.
Some of them had a month. Some of them had 2 months. I think most I ever had was like 4 months, and then the rest of it was scattered among various other tasks.
Okay. And so who were the other, those other two people?
The Campbell Creek Science Center coordinator was Kathy Liska.
Okay.
And the other outdoor recreation planner was Jake Schlapfer.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard his name. I'm trying to spell it, Schlapfer.
Schlapfer, something
yeah,
like that.
Right. In terms of your role with the Iditarod, what kind of things did you do?
Well, pretty much the whole gamut. Initially, it was I first got there was I got a call from a group of the Alaska prospectors. Now, I didn't know what they were, but they were a kind of a fraternal group of older folks in Anchorage that met periodically, and they'd have sit down sessions where they drink coffee and eat cookies and talk about various things. And nice lady who asked me to come over there and talk to them about the Iditarod. I thought, well, okay, yeah, I'll go over there, and figured there'd be 8 or 10 people sitting around a table and drinking coffee and talking. Well, I got to the meeting. It turned out it was over at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and it was there were 200 plus people there.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it was kind of like, whoa, what am I got myself into? Well, I had my little 20 minute slideshow, and I told them, most of the people, the average age is probably 70 to 75. I said, well, I'm new here, and I don't really know much about it. You people probably know more about it than I do, but I'll tell you what I know. So did the slideshow. They all liked it, except one guy who was, he was thinking that I was associated with a sled dog race, and he was pretty adamant he wanted to see that stop because of the potential for, animal cruelty. And I'm going, well, no, that isn't what I'm doing. This is the historic trail. So after a while, he was somewhat placated by the rest of the crowd. And anyway, people were happy with the meeting. It turned out well. And one old gentleman stopped by as I was putting my stuff away. And here's your, caricature of an old prospector. And he was wearing an Alaska tuxedo. I don't know if you are familiar with that term, but Woolrich used to make semi-fancy clothes for woods workers.
Mm-hmm.
They were worsted wool and had a lot of snaps and pockets. And anyway, they're called Alaska tuxedos, and I hadn't seen one of those in a long time, but he was wearing them, and he said, he says, I enjoyed your slideshow on the Iditarod. It's been some time since I've seen that. Well, Iditarod's a ghost town. I said, well, when was the last time you were there? He says, well, I used to deliver the mail by dog sled in the 30s.
Hmm.
And I thought, yeah, here's an opportunity to connect with someone who was actually a part of that culture. This is not a distant memory like a prehistoric tribe. This is people you can talk to who are there. And that was kind of a wake-up call for what the historic aspect of the trail was about. His name was Tony Gilardi. And Tony's long gone now, but I tried to sit down with him and get him to do an oral history, sort of like what you're doing here,
right.
But I don't want to talk about that. He'd say, I spent too much time talking already, and I forgot most of what I remembered. So so I could sort of relate to Tony on this topic. But that was kind of the contact for what got me more focused into the historical aspects of the trail rather than as a recreational facility.
Right. Well, and I know... your predecessors with the comprehensive management plan, they did sort of an oral history project on historic uses of the trail.
Right.
So at least some of that information was captured. I think
sure.
that was in
sure.
80 or 81, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's interesting. That certainly making that personal connection with that guy, that's why I do what I do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that kind of brought it home.
Yeah. And speaking of your predecessors, so Terry O'Sullivan and Dean Littlepage were actually trail administrators prior to you, correct?
Right. I only met Terry, I believe, one time, briefly, and Dean, once or twice. So I really didn't have a lot of contact with either of them personally. But, of course, I was aware of what they did as far as projects and working on the comprehensive plan.
Uh-huh. And then how do you feel like what they accomplished, was it worthwhile?
Well, it was foundational.
Yeah.
I mean, it was foundational. That's basically what we had to go by. And, they did some great work. Wish that there was a better opportunity to, carry through on a lot of it, but, the function with the budget and the bureaucracy that we dealt with is a little tough to continue in the manner to which you would like to have followed.
Yeah, and in most positions, you don't get to overlap with your predecessor and get trained by them.
True, that's true.
What kind of things did you inherit from them? What were some of those foundational things they had accomplished that were useful
for
you?
One of the last things that Dean worked on was the Tripod Flats cabin. And they built a cabin at Tripod Flats, out of Caltag. And it was a work of art. I mean, this is something that they spent like a month on. They got the logs skidded in there, and they spent, four or five guys spent a month carving this cabin into very picturesque, you know, calendar quality facility.
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful cabin. The downside is it took a month to do it, and, you know, we really couldn't afford the staff time for four or five people to do that. And while it was a great start, it was not something that we could do on a regular basis. You know, we had some demands, not demands, but some requests from advisory council and other folks to, you know, build some shelter cabins to take the place of some of the roadhouses that had been there over, you know, the heyday of the trail. And, you know, the need was there. So, yeah, that was one of the projects that we built upon. We started building cabins. We started doing some clearing in areas, especially across the Farewell Burn, and trail marking. And, of course, a lot of interpretive stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about anything that Terry O'Sullivan did?
Well, again, I'm trying to recall. This is 30 years ago or more.
I know.
Specifically, it would be related to things like easement acquisition,
okay,
and working with a lot of the other partners that are part of the advisory council.
Right. Okay. Well, and as you said, for your work on it, you were sort of doing collateral duty for the trail, but Dean and Terry, that was their primary job, right?
As far as I know.
And so why did that change? And, you know, because now the Kevin Keeler, who's the current administrator, it's his primary duty.
I know, I hired him.
So how come during your time it was a collateral situation?
Well, I think it was a kind of a growing thing with BLM. They weren't quite sure how to deal with it. You know, the BLM is kind of a commodity-oriented organization, at least it was. You know, things were based on how many board feet of timber you put out, how many animal unit months for grazing, how many recreation permits were issued. So this was kind of one of those amorphous sorts of situations that they weren't real familiar with. You know, you're protecting or you're managing an entity that doesn't really have any widgets associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you've got so many miles of trail, but, you know, you don't own the trail. You know, you only own parts of it, and you're actively in the process of conveying a lot of it out of federal ownership. So one of the questions I used to get a lot from people in Washington, well, what do you do the rest of the year?
Right.
You know, they had this impression that, you know, okay, you're only working during the sled dog race. And I go, well, no, not really. It took a long time to get them focused into the fact that there was more to it than that, the fact that the you know, the Susan Butcher was running the race.
Right. And I think that's still the case. I can tell you, when I was informed about this project, I didn't realize that the trail had this very distinct history, and then all the history of management and following a comprehensive plan.
That's it was a tough sell. And then later on, you know, toward the end of the time I was there, I used to get a lot of people from Washington wanted to do, hey, I'd like to come out and visit the Iditarod and see what that's all about. Of course, they wanted to come during the race. And, you know, they wanted sort of the VIP treatment, if you will. And that got kind of tenuous at times because, you know, we're always short of funds. And, of course, they want to go visit the trail in the wintertime. About the only way you can do that is by helicopter. So that's not a very good visual for folks. It doesn't really set a good precedent. So balance that.
In terms of from the local community view of having somebody drop in by helicopter?
Yeah, well, when you've got, you know, like, for give an example, Roan, you know, an airstrip there, and, you know, you've got mushers that have been fighting the trail for 2 days to get to Roan. They're exhausted, and they're trying to get their dogs to sleep, and here comes this helicopter with, you know, a few bureaucrats get out, snap a bunch of photos, smile, and pose for the camera, and then they're off to the next site. That doesn't leave a good impression with folks.
Right.
We tried to avoid that as much as possible, but there were those that thought it was their duty to do fact-finding, but they'll remain nameless.
Okay. Well, as yet, it's a not uncommon discrepancy between the people in Alaska in the field and the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. It's, I think it's a requirement. There was a, I know at the start of the Iditarod that, you know, downtown, it was always a, you know, a hot ticket to get a VIP pass to the start. And a lot of people wanted it, and that was difficult because, you know, we have an ongoing relationship with the Trail Committee for help. You know, we help them, and, you know, they do some projects for us, and pretty tough to say, hey, would you give us some VIP passes for folks to stand there at the start of the finish line or starting line?
Right.
And that's just it's a hard thing to do, and that was one of the things that I think was one of the most annoying parts of my job was having to deal with that.
Yeah, well, and the fact that you had to deal with it in terms of trying to sell Iditarod stuff, it wasn't your supervisors higher up the chain, the managers?
Well, some of them were, yeah. Some of them looked upon it as an opportunity to create goodwill toward their supervisors. So, yeah, there was a little bit of that, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, you mentioned sort of sharing the duties with Jake and Kathy. How did that work? What kind of other things did they do? How did you guys split all that out?
Well, when the Campbell Creek Science Center was pretty much a full-time job for her.
Yeah.
I mean, that was her main role. She was involved with the design and the contracting work. And, you know, that was a
easy break, yeah.
Yeah, she did not do a lot on the Iditarod occasionally. You know, there'd be some planning issues. Jake, on the other hand, you know, he did a lot of the on-the-ground work. He did a lot of the marking, the building, all of the cabin projects he was involved with the construction on. And, you know, trail maintenance as well. Whoever was available, we'd draft them and they'd go out and do it.
Okay.
But his primary role was in permitting, mostly guides and outfitters.
And were there guides and outfitters using the Iditarod Trail?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. The Iditarod Trail Race is a special recreation permitted activity. So there's a permit associated with that. Same with the Iron Dog. You know, the Idita Sport. I mean, at the time, there was the Idita Sport and the Idita Bike. And,
right.
And we were jokingly referring that maybe we ought to have the Idita Cat run Caterpillar tractors across the Farewell Burn to, you know, brush out the trail. That never transpired, but maybe would have been a fair idea. But and then we had a lot of guides and outfitters all over the western part of Alaska as well. But yeah, there were a variety. There was groups that did snow machine tours and sled dog tours, and we even had one guy who. I don't think he was contracted, but he actually, permitted, but he did, he'd get a couple, three Super Cubs on skis, and he'd fly the route of the Iditarod.
Hmm.
And he'd land at Farewell and Roan and various other locations along the line.
Yeah, I say, if he was flying and using existing airstrips, he wouldn't have needed to be permitted?
Usually not, but if he had a base, like if he was based at, like Roan, for example, that's a BLM site.
Okay.
But, they were stop and go, so no, he wasn't permitted in that regard.
Right. I mean, obviously the races and those recreational activities, yes, I could see they'd need a permit, but I didn't realize that there were people guiding private groups out there, as you say, for tours.
Yep, they did that as well as, you know, there were commercial hunting operations that would be either based occasionally out of Roan, sometimes out of Farewell. Through the burn, you know, there was a popular area to hunt moose. Same thing along, you know, the Caltag to Unalakleet portions.
Huh. Okay. Never occurred to me. Again, you know, it's like, okay, the trail gets used for the race in the winter, and then nobody's using it. Is kind of the impression that, you know.
Well, parts of it are, you know, because it, you know, historically is, you know, has been an access route between the villages. Especially the part between. Caltag and Unalakleet.
Right.
A lot of that is on the river, but you know, some of it is accessible. But you got to be awful hardy to get there.
Yeah. Right. Well, and as you say, you know, parts of it, use in the summer is impossible. It's all swampland. But the Seward through Crow Pass, Eagle River.
The Forest Service, the area from Seward and through Crow Pass along the Forest Service, there's a lot of accessible property there, or ground there that's usable.
Right. And at the time when you were working with the trail in the 90s, was the Forest Service actively involved and in starting to recognize the trail, or did that come later?
Well, they were. You know, one of the advisory council members was Dwayne Harp from the Forest Service. And, we worked fairly closely with Dwayne and eventually with others on the Chugach to coordinate activities. So, yeah, they gradually became more involved with the trail. At first, I think there was a feeling, well, this is BLM's trail, we're not going to bother with it, and it was kind of a lower priority. But I think as it became more popular, I think a lot more interest occurred with the agencies, and they took a larger role.
And did that happen during your tenure?
I think it started during, it grew out of the advisory council and some of the recommendations the advisory council made.
Okay. Speaking of the advisory council, why don't we talk about them?
Sure.
And how that worked and how you at BLM interacted with them.
Okay. Well, like I say, I got there in 92, and we had, I think the first meeting we had of the advisory council I was at was in Anchorage in our office. And there was a little bit of how can I put it? They were not particularly happy with the agency. I guess one of the previous one of the previous supervisors had kind of blown them off and gone on a float trip during the time that they were scheduled to meet. And I think that led them to a little bit of concern that maybe they weren't being very well respected for their efforts. So there was a role in trying to overcome that. The other thing is, of course, we were never very well funded, and there was a lot of interest in the council for getting things done, for getting projects accomplished. And I think they may have got a little tired of listening to the fact that, well, we don't have the money for it, we don't have the bodies to do it, we'll do what we can. And I think over time we were able to overcome some of that. We did get some cabins built, we got some trails marked, we got some interpretive materials prepared that assuaged a little bit of that angst. We had some issues with the reservation of easements, because at the time, and probably still to this day somewhat, the agency, BLM, is one of the big roles to convey lands both to the state and to Native corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And, we had a large land staff that was their job. Let's convey this, let's identify lands that need to go out. They were all about counting how many miles and acres and lands they could get toward, moved out of federal ownership. Well, sometimes there was an attitude there that maybe reserving easements and rights away wasn't all that important. And that was a concern amongst most of us.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the variety of easements and rights away that were reserved were kind of confusing, to say the least. The Native corporations mostly wanted like a 25-foot easement for an identified trail. The state was willing to go with a 400-foot easement mostly, and the advisory council pretty much wanted 1,000 feet. Everywhere, which wasn't real possible or wasn't doable. So there were a lot of compromises and a lot of adjustments on easements and rights of way. And I'm sure to this point, there's lots of areas of trails that don't have an easement or right of way established.
Right.
So it's kind of a discontinuous, imaginary trail in places.
Yeah. Well, and it is interesting though what you just said about how, BLM's purpose was to convey land out away from BLM, but here's this trail that you have management authority over that some of us would think you would need to be owning that land to be...
Well, that's kind of the dichotomy, because there were people within the agency who was going, well, this is... We don't have any trail responsibilities. What's the deal here, that, I think, has changed somewhat. It's become a lot more apparent, and it's more important than what people gave it credit for initially.
Mm-hmm. and it is confusing to think that you have authority over managing a trail, but you don't own the land that the trail is mm-hmm. crossing.
Exactly. I think one of the, they tried to, it was kind of interesting to deal with other agencies like the Park Service, because the Park Service has most of the other National Historic Trails.
Right.
And they do have a greater control, if you will, over those. Of course, there's a lot more history with those, with the way they manage, you know, linear parks, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And those were helpful in convincing some of BLM's management that maybe we need to look a little closer at how we do this.
Mm-hmm.
We did. I know the Oregon Trail has there's a visitor center in Baker City that is BLM, that runs by BLM, even though the Oregon Trail is not administered by BLM. But it has a portion of it, so they highlight it. That's something that we were always hopeful to get, with some sort of a facility to, you know, to highlight the trail. I don't believe that's ever even come close to happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned the Park Service. It has me thinking about Klondike National Historical Park, where the mm-hmm. trail is the main thing in the park and their main
right.
point of interpretation. They own the land that it's going over.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a, I don't mean to, well, it's a slippery slope, if you will, Choku Trail included, but that was put upon. It's kind of a learning experience for everyone.
So did you guys look to the Choku Trail and Klondike as examples of?
We did not at the time.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder why.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we're certainly aware of it. I mean, I hiked that Choku Trail myself, but
right.
You know, it wasn't. It was. I guess a lot of it was, well, this is a Park Service thing, you know, and it's a little different kind of a
mm-hmm.
an agency to deal with. I mean, and at the same time, you know, the Park Service would put on a National Trail Managers meeting, and we attend most years.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot from your counterparts.
Right.
And we brought Steve Elkington out from the Park Service and Gary Warner from the Ice Age Trail to help with some of our discussions at the Advisory Council, which kind of led, well, that's leading into how we, you know, sunsetted the council and went into the nonprofit. But they were very helpful in that regard to show other ways of doing things in other places.
Yeah, and that's just an interesting relationship that BLM being a federal agency with management authority, but you have a council who's asking for things to be done, and how that works or doesn't work.
Well, you know, again, it goes back to a lot of it is dollars. Everybody had ideas on what to do
mm-hmm.
and what was necessary and what was required. Joe Reddington, you know, got to do easements out of Kinnick, got to, you know, keep the private ownerships from blocking the trail. You know, Irene Anderson in Nome, you know, she was a land manager for Sitnisock. You know, she was concerned with how it affects the communities in the area. You know, we had places where the trail would cross through abandoned villages, and there were, you know, surface burials in those areas. I remember being on a snow machine in February, stopped for a cup of coffee and realized I'm sitting in the middle of a graveyard, you know, of basically surface burials.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no, we can't have the trail there. That's not appropriate. So we would work with I think it was Guy Martin at the time from Bering Sea. We'd move the trail. Okay, well, yeah, it isn't exactly where it used to be, but at least it's not running over somebody's ancestor.
Right.
So there was a lot of situational type things that we'd work on, but it, you know, it became apparent that because of the funding issues, that a lot of things we'd like to do we couldn't do, and the only way we could do that is if we had some sort of a nonprofit entity that
okay.
could raise funds, and that's what we did. You know, the Advisory Council was chartered through, well, from 1978, and it got an extension to go to 1998. And it became apparent that, you know, we were not going to be able to renew it past 1998. You know, so it was a time to say, look, let's look at doing a nonprofit. So we started, I did a primarily with the existing advisory council members, with some new folks that came on board. And you know, the first thing they did was look for a fundraiser, somebody to get grants. Mm-hmm. And they hired an individual to solicit grants. And I think, as I recall, initially they got a large monetary grant from, I think it was American Express, for, I want to say, like $40,000 or something like that. But, you know, that kind of got the ball rolling, and they got other people involved. Jim Palin and Lee Pileski and others who were out on the council became a part of that. And, it started to roll. And that was an opportunity to get a little bit of push as far as funding and get some projects done that the agencies couldn't afford to do.
Okay.
Especially on non-federal ownership.
Oh, I see. So on parts of the trail that you guys didn't own, you could not do any projects.
Yeah, we couldn't build a cabin on, say, for example, state land with federal funds.
Okay.
So we were limited on where we could spend federal funds on the ground projects.
Okay. Even if you were partnering with the state?
Well, we had agreements, but it was at the time there was so little money to go around, it really wasn't that much of an issue.
Okay. I was going to ask something about the... I forgot what I was going to ask.
We did provide a lot of interpretive materials and signage and things like that, but yeah, those were obviously on areas that weren't federal ownership.
So, as you said, that first meeting you went to, the council was not very happy with BLM. How did you kind of smooth that out and build a relationship?
Well, I mean, it was a matter of spending a lot more time talking to folks outside of the bounds of the council. You know, I mean, I was probably on the phone with Leo Rasmussen, you know, every week or so. You know, Judy Bittner was down the street at the SHPO's office. You know, so it was more than just sitting in that formal atmosphere. It was more a one-on-one type of a thing. We did a lot of work with the Iditarod Trail Committee. There was a rep on the advisory council. Greg Bill was the Iditarod Trail Committee representative. So we worked one-on-one with most of the entities. Same thing with the Native corporations, with Irene Anderson and Guy Martin and others. And then, of course, Dan Seavey and Seward with the Trailblazers. He was not shy about getting on the phone and calling and no. Wondering what was happening. Why aren't you doing this? So, yeah, it was a lot more one-on-one, person-to-person kinds of communications than it had possibly been in the past. I think a lot of times at least the feeling I had before I got there was that there were meetings only because it was required to have a meeting, you know, so many times a year.
Okay. And you had this comprehensive plan, the trail management plan, that you were supposed to sort of be following as a guiding document. Is that right?
Right. That's correct. But, you know, again, it was a generalized, if I'm trying to recall what all was in it, it gave some parameters, but, you know, we did what we could with what we had, I'll put it that way.
So, yeah, you feel like you were following those guidelines?
For the most part, as much as we could.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we'd like to implement more, but, you know, things being what they were, it was hard to get to that point.
And so once the council changed over into, well, it's now called the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance, did that change how you guys worked together?
Well, I think we still had a lot of the same contacts. You know, I don't think we had the official meetings. That, again, was pretty much toward the end of my tenure on the trail. I mean, I'd moved into other positions at the time with peripheral contact with the trail. But yeah, no, I had many, many conversations with Jim Palin and Judy over the years on what we should be doing and how we should be doing it. It was regardless of who was doing what the job title was from the individual.
Can you remember any of those particular things that Jim and Judy were pushing for?
Well, Jim's thing, I think, was mostly funding for positions. They wanted to get administrative. You wanted to get the BLM to pay for administrative help. And as
To help the council or the alliance.
Yeah, the incorporated, right. At the time it was INHT Inc. But I don't think we ever got to that point until they were able to get the grant from Amex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helped in moving in that direction.
Okay.
But I think it was a good thing from the standpoint of those members of the council who transitioned were better able to realize what the funding parameters were, because they could raise their own funds.
Mm-hmm.
to an extent. And it wasn't like there was a, it wasn't, I'm trying to think of a way to say this without causing any issues. It's almost like a big brother sort of a thing, you know, kind of push people out of the nest for not depend on the government to provide everything.
Okay.
Not that the government was providing everything, it was a problem.
I see. Okay. And what kind of things was Judy pushing for?
Well, of course, her interest as a SHPO was the historic preservation aspect and the interpretation. So several times, I'm trying to think, well, several times, a couple times, I think we went to a trail managers meeting in Independence, Missouri, to Kansas City. So, she was put in contact with the Park Service and other trail managers to see how they related to some of the projects that were specific to their own issues. Like, there were a variety of different things that they had going on. For example, the Over Mountain Victory Trail in Tennessee, they owned no property. They had a march. Their big thing was they had a commemorative march every year of their militia across, I think it was the Cumberland Gap area. And totally different kind of a process, but it was still a historic trail. And so, given a greater overview of what we could look at for interpreting and highlighting the historical aspect of the trail.
Mm-hmm. And during your time, did you guys do any historic preservation of any of the old roadhouses? That's the only thing I can think that might have still been out there, or old cabins.
Well, we did look at, at Flat and Iditarod, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We did a survey of Flat and Iditarod. When we built the old woman cabin, the part of the Goodwin survey, I believe, if I might be mistaken, but I believe that part of that was to survey a route for the Wamcats, the Washington, Alaska Military
Right.
Communication and Telegraph Line, I think that was the acronym. We actually, when we excavated the foundation footers for the cabin, we found the line.
Oh.
Found insulators from the Wamcats line. And that, of course, we didn't collect them. They're still there on site, but that's where the Wamcats went through. So it was, right on the historic site.
I'm surprised that the archaeologists or cultural resources people let you leave those out there.
I don't think they wanted to bring them in and catalog them, but they're in situ, they're on site there.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be found, but I'm not telling anybody where they are. So
I would think for all of those cabins and anything where you're doing construction, you must have had to do archaeological clearance.
Yes. We did, and they were not discovered. But they were, it was addressed that it was on the site of the Wamcats. That's how we knew it was a Wamcats line.
Okay.
There's an insulator. I wonder what that's from. Well, we knew what it was when we found it.
Right. There'd be no other reason for it to be out there.
Not as far as you could tell.
Right. So that cabin, you had archaeology.
Well, all of our sites were where they were addressed, if you will. The Bear Creek cabin was, it was the middle of a burn. There was really nothing there other than, standing dead black spruce.
Mm-hmm.
And
were those like the old woman cabin, Bear Creek, were those existing old shelter cabins that you guys?
No, there was nothing there.
Okay, you guys, those are new ones you built.
Yes, those are cabin kits.
Okay.
Those we actually after building Tripod Flats, it was so expensive and time consuming that we excuse me, went to a process of making a prefabricated log cabin kit in Fairbanks, and then for Bear Creek, we ended up flying the cabin into the Farewell airstrip, and then ferrying the parts in with a helicopter. Mm-hmm. You know, we had, it was this fire aircraft for fire season, so they were available in the area. And, you know, it wasn't cheap, but it was certainly, you know, it wasn't going to take a month to put on. It took like a week to build each of the cabins. The same thing at Unalakleet, the old woman, we'd fly, I think we had a Sherpa, we'd fly the materials into Unalakleet and then ferry it in with the helicopter. And, you know, we'd, in a week we'd have it up.
And so, was there any restoration? I mean, you said you surveyed flat and Iditarod. You guys didn't go and restore any of the old buildings there, did you?
No, they were not restored. The old, at the time, was it the Alaska Commercial Company store?
Mm-hmm.
Parts of it were still standing in Iditarod. You know, I think the bank vault from Iditarod was still there in the open. Of course, it's a concrete cube, so it's not going anywhere.
Right.
You know, and over the years, you know, before, you know, since the time it was in operation, a lot of it's either deteriorated or has been repurposed by other people into some of their own ownership. So.
Yeah, and I say by the 90s, any of those old roadhouses that would have been on the original trail were probably way past.
Pretty much all gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Except I think there was one site down on the Chugach that might have had a structure associated with it. I don't recall exactly what. I think we went out and looked at it, but I can't remember that there was anything we did with it.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, when the designation was obtained in 78, there might have still been a few old roadhouses that they could have done something with, but not by the 90s.
Yeah, there was really not a whole lot other than flat and Iditarod.
Right. And by now, there's probably even less out there.
Well, the weather takes a toll, you know, and, you know, there's always souvenir hunters.
Yes.
Which is, brings up another issue, but that's when we did our signage. You know, we had a little the pregnant triangle, if you will, the standard trail markers, which all the National Historic Trails have. We had our own little design that they were very popular. Unfortunately, they were popular with everybody who saw them, so they were almost impossible to keep on the trail because they'd get picked off as souvenirs. I always thought that would be a great thing for the nonprofit to do, was produce a bunch of signs and sell them.
Did they ever do that?
I don't know that they did or not. I know we gave a lot to them. We did a lot of things like buttons and pins and things like that, you know, little like lapel pins for the Iditarod.
Yeah, and I know there's stickers. And.
No, these were actually quite, you know, they were enamelware and, you know, they're very, very high quality. But the plastic signs, that was, you know, we had an issue with the Park Service on that because the Park Service had their own design shop that did their interpretive signs and their logo signs for all the trails. And the designers didn't like what we had, you know, for the Iditarod, because apparently it didn't fit their standard. And anyway, we had a lot of conversations back and forth, and they provided a couple of examples of what they thought would be more appropriate, and I rejected them because they reminded me of basically something that the University of Washington would want on a jersey. It looked like a Husky, but it didn't have the sled on it and, you know, the logo. So, and that logo that we use is actually Bill Devine from Connect Trailblazers designed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same Husky that's on the Iditarod Trail logo. So we took that in a sled, and that's our trail logo for the trail.
And that wasn't already developed? That happened during your time?
Well, the signage was later on. But it had evolved from the original one that was in the management plan.
Okay.
But they were both done by Bill Devine.
Okay.
Bill Devine cleaned it up a little.
So there were.
He was a graphic artist who did it.
Yeah, I've heard his name. So when you started, there were some signs on the trail, and then you guys added to them, or you redesigned them?
Well,
both?
They had a kind of a square sign that had a decal on it. What we did reason for that is because during the winter, everybody's, you know, it's usually dark. And they're either on a snow machine or got a headlamp on the sled so they can pick up the reflector from a distance.
Oh, okay. So were those put in on laths, or you put them on trees? Or, well, there's certain places there are no trees, but...
Yeah, well, where there were trees, you could, you know, the trail was a little easier to follow because usually it was brushed. And the trees had blazes on them. You could see the blazes where they'd blaze the trail through there. And then, you know, you'd hang nail reflectors to trees where you could. And, they were very usable. Places, of course, where there weren't trees, we tried to use tripods as much as possible. So we used whatever we could find. Like on Bering Sea coast, for example, we picked logs up off the beach and wire them together into a tripod to act as a signpost. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the standard design. But a lot of places you didn't have anything. So we went to using Norm Messenger, our guy in Nome at the time. He went out to the AC and bought a whole bunch of 2x2 posts and fashioned those into tripods. You know, at least they could be packed and carried on a snow machine or on a boat and put up where needed, where there wasn't anything else. And then, you know, during the race, you know, the race committee would put out lath, and that's mm-hmm. Pretty common. That's because you're kind of hard to take a 8-foot log out there and put it up where you're 50 miles from the nearest tree.
Right. So you guys tried to have it marked all the time, and then the race committee would kind of add to that?
Sure. And there'd be places, of course, where they couldn't, you know, where there'd be overflow or something where they couldn't use the trail, and they'd have to, you know, detour around it for the race. So, yeah.
Okay.
But no, the trail committee did lots of marking with lath.
Yeah.
But we tried to improve that into a more permanent marker when we could.
Okay. Because I was going to say, like out on the Yukon River, obviously, you know, anything you mark in the winter, you can't mark that in the summer. So.
Oh, sure. Well, it's the river. It's going to stay on the river, right?
I can see you during the race, those sections would have needed to be marked specifically.
Right. And of course, you know, the Iron Dog in those years used to follow much of the same trail, so they would piggyback on use. You know,
right.
The Iron Dog would run through, and then, you know, whatever they could use, the trail committee could use, they would follow the same course.
Right. So yeah, so BLM didn't get out there and break trail and pack it down and brush it out.
Somewhat. But generally, I've been on the trail in February on a snow machine marking trail, but wasn't a regular part of the job. During the summer, you know, when we could, we'd go out and rush the trail as we could get to it. But, it was kind of an expensive trip to get out there.
Right.
Especially if you had to go by helicopter. But, I spent a fair amount of time out of Nome along the Bering Sea coast, putting up tripods in February. It kind of some interesting experiences out there, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell me about some of them?
Well, I guess it was February one year. Norm Messenger and I were marking trail with tripods that we'd made, and we got past safety, and it was, probably 30 below zero. It was cold. And we'd run out of tripods, so it was time to head home. And we had two snow machines. Norm took off, and I got onto my machine. It wouldn't start. And I'm thinking, no, this is not good. So it's amazing how quiet it is out there when there's nobody around. But, I spent, an hour trying to get it started, and I was looking for places where maybe I could burn some wood to stay warm. About that time, I hear Norm show up, and he comes back with a machine. And fortunately, he had a little de-icing fluid in his machine, so we got the ice out of my carburetor and got started and went back. But I had got to have a real wilderness experience there to understand just how cold it can get.
Yeah. Oh, well, pretty scary to all of a sudden realize you're sort of trapped out there in the elements.
Well, you know, I wasn't really, I was well dressed, but still, it would have been very uncomfortable.
Yeah. And you knew enough to stay with the machine and not start walking?
No, well, there wasn't much choice, you know. You tilt it up on its side and pack some snow around it and keep out of the wind.
Yeah.
But, no, there was a lot of interesting experiences over the years. I mean, most of them involved bears, but that one was one that didn't.
So what was one of the bear experiences?
Well, let's see. Well, when we were working one summer on Roan, of course, Roan gets used a lot. It's because there's an airstrip there, and a lot of stuff gets flown in there and doesn't get blown out. So we were constantly picking up trash and old oil drums and things like that, and concentrating them around the cabin so that during the Iditarod, when they would bring in supplies for the mushers, they could backhaul a lot of the junk, like old drums and stuff like that. So we'd collect them during the summer and bring them to the end of the airstrip and flatten them out. Well, one time we'd done that, and I'd found a couple of drums at the opposite end of the airstrip from the cabin, and I thought, well, I'll just roll these down the airstrip, about a 1,200-foot gravel strip, roll them down there, and we can kind of stage them over there so they could be hauled out during the race. Well, it makes a lot of noise when you roll a steel drum over gravel.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, okay, no big deal. And I kind of had some feeling something was watching me. I turn around and look, and there's this brown bear following me. I thought, well, this isn't good. So I'm continuing to roll the drums. I get about 150 yards from the helicopter, and the pilot's sitting in the helicopter because there's a lot of mosquitoes out, and you didn't particularly want to get out in the mosquitoes. And so I'm waving at him to, make the motion to start that rotor spinning, and he sees me, and he must have noticed there was a bear behind me, so he fires up the helicopter. And the bear's, slowly following me, maybe 20 yards behind. I'm not running or anything. I'm just kind of aware of him. The bear is kind of seeing that helicopter rotor start to spin. He's getting kind of interested. And he's kind of focused on the rotor. About that time, I abandoned the drums and ran over and got the helicopter. And pilot pulled pitch on the helicopter right about the time the bear got to the helicopter. Wow. He was reaching for the skids, but he didn't quite get to it. So that was entertaining.
Yeah, that sounds pretty exciting.
Well, it was memorable. Another time when we were building the Old Woman cabin, it's right at the base of Old Woman, and I don't know if you've seen the mountain, but it's a lot of loose talus rock, so it's a lot of loose rock coming off of it. Well, I got up one morning when we had individual little backpacking tents that we were staying in while we were building the cabin, and they were lined up there at the base of the mountain. And I got up early, and I was making coffee, and I heard this crunching noise, and I went, what the heck is that? And I looked up, and there's a brown bear coming down the mountain toward the tents. And I'm thinking, this isn't good. So, when we go to the woods, we usually carry a firearm for bears, a shotgun. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there going, I really don't want to shoot this bear, and as long as it's not bothering anything, I'm not going to get excited. But the bear came down, and he sniffed at the front of each one of those tents.
Wow.
He didn't touch them, but he sniffed at all of them. And, and all the other people are there sleeping. They're oblivious to all of this. And the bear gets to the last tent, and he proceeds to empty his bowels right in front of the tent. And he took one look over his shoulder at me, because I think he was probably had some experience with people with guns. So he didn't, he was wary. So he continued on, went down to the river to go catch some fish or whatever he was going to do. And shortly after that, people started getting up, and they came to the coffee pot, and I was telling them, I said, there was a bear in there sniffing at your tent. None of them believed me, but, you're making this up. That's ridiculous. The bear didn't come out there. Finally, the last guy in line comes out of his tent, and he was upset. He comes, he wanted to know who had dropped that bear crap in front of his tent. He couldn't understand how it was so fresh. It was still steamy. How we did that. And after that, he realized that I was telling him what had happened, and I don't think we got much sleep until we got the walls up on that cabin. So, there was always something interesting going on in the woods.
But fortunately, you didn't have any bear encounters that ended in injury or anything, or destruction?
Not on the job. I've had other experiences with bears and, my normal recreational pursuits, but not on the job.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, you did get to spend some time out on the trail.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That was a joy. That was always fun. There's less bureaucracy involved.
Well, you had mentioned on the phone, too, about Nome, there was something about Leo Rasmussen and...
Well, one of the things about the trail that always struck me was the connections, is connectivity. It was not only that it was connecting villages and towns and places on the ground, it was connecting people. You'd run into people and the connection was through the Iditarod.
Mm-hmm.
During the end of the race, a number of years, I would go to Nome and I'd set up we had a portable display that we'd put up, interpretive display, and we'd hand out posters and pamphlets and talk to people. And there were quite a few people that came to Nome for the end of the race. We'd set up in the little convention center there in Nome. And there'd be people from all over the world show up. Well, one time, I was manning this display, an older woman and her daughter came in, and they were, obviously out of place. They were not locals. And they were asking about the Iditarod, and I talked to them for, half an hour or so, and I asked them where they were from, and they were from, I can't remember if it was Maryland or Connecticut, but it was somewhere back east. And I said, well, do you have some affinity for sled dog racing or that would cause you to come to Nome? So, oh, no, it was Alaska. They'd never been to Alaska before, and they wanted to visit Alaska. And I said, well, you picked an interesting place and time to do it. And he said, well, we have a relative that had a part in Alaska's history. And I go, well, who's that? Well, it turned out it was Seward.
Huh.
They were direct descendants of Seward. Of course, the individual purchased Alaska. And I believe he was the Secretary of State
right.
at the time. And so this kind of went, whoa. So I called Leo up, and Leo at the time was the mayor of Nome.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Leo, hey, we got some people here you got to meet. And Leo's kind of a sort of amateur historian. So he came down and we talked. So he invited these folks over to his house, and we had coffee and cookies and sat there and talked for a good 2 or 3 hours about Seward, about Alaska, about the history, about the Iditarod. And they were just stunned. I don't think they expected this level of, interpretation that they got from, their visit. But we were so impressed that they had taken the time to come back to see what their ancestor had developed. So that was a great an opportunity to, carry that connection thing through. Another time, I think it was, I'm trying to remember when Robert Sorley, the Norwegian, won the race. I think it was, someone said, like 2003.
Yeah.
Anyway, the same kind of deal. I'm sitting there in Nome at my display that I brought out there, and it's one of his sponsors from Norway was there. And I got to talking with him, and I had spent, when I was in high school, I had spent a summer working on a farm in Norway.
Hmm.
And so trying to get an opportunity to practice my Norwegian, which was almost non-existent. But, the sponsor for Sorley was a dog food manufacturer. He did pet foods all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a brochure of his company, and it had an aerial photo of his facility. It was outside of Lillehammer, Norway. And I looked at that aerial photo, and I said, hey, that farm right there in that aerial photo, that's the one I worked on.
Hmm.
I could identify it from the photo. And he says, oh. And he mentioned that his wife was the daughter of the farmer whose farm I worked on, so I knew her. So there's another connection.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of... One more. This is another one. National Geographic did a book series on the National Historic Trails, and there was a chapter on the Iditarod. So one of their researchers called to ask about the history of the Iditarod and how it's going. Anyway... So I talked to her for some time, and she made a comment about how this is, the winters are so awful, the climate is terrible, how could you stand that? And I said, look, I said, when I lived in Northern Virginia, two-a-day football practices in the summertime were a lot more miserable than being out in below zero temperatures and, on the Bering Sea coast.
Right.
It is, to me, that was the most miserable experience I ever had. And she goes, where in Northern Virginia? Well, it turned out we went to high school together. Didn't know each other, but we had gone to high school together. So, yeah, there's connections all over the place with the Iditarod in various... You just have to look for them.
Well, that seems... The world in general often is like that.
It's very small. These,
yeah. Well, and you had also said something about Leo Rasmussen and marking the trail or something, or was that same story about the Seward?
That was pretty much the Seward thing, yeah.
Okay. Well, another thing you had mentioned that you were involved with was the 100th anniversary celebration in Seward.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, that was near the end of my career. It's 2008. Lee Pulaski, the Resurrection Base historian, he was quite a character. I mean, he was to my mind, was the ultimate historian, because he got to the nitty-gritty of everything. Well, he had discovered that, you know, in 1908, when the Goodwins were doing, and Goodwin was doing his survey, that, you know, we were coming across 2008. Hey, what an opportunity to have a centennial celebration. So he put that together with the Trailblazers, with the Seward Trailblazers, and he and Dan and a number of other folks. And they just invited a bunch of folks to show up and have a, you know, I won't say impromptu, there was some planning involved. But it was an invitation to a bunch of folks to come out and celebrate the, you know, the 100th anniversary of the survey of the trail. So it was held there at the marker, at the mile zero marker in Seward on the trail. And Governor Palin came and spoke, and it was just a miserably cold, windy day. And to her credit, she stood out there all day long and talked to everyone who wanted to talk to her. And the rest of us are sitting there stamping our feet and shivering, and she's out there, you know, playing the role, and she did a great job at it. Beyond that, we eventually talked her into going inside, and for the rest of us who were getting cold, you know, to speak there, but it was basically just a I won't say informal, but a less than formal meeting of folks who were interested in the trail. No, there were not any great celebrations that I recall.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how they kind of got the word out? I mean, to invite people, or was it a public event?
Yeah, it was a public event. It was advertised, but I think, you know, the invitations I know came with the governor, and then, you know, of course I got an invitation to come do my little slideshow presentation. I believe Kevin was there. I don't recall. It's been.
It's been a while.
It's been 20 plus years, so not quite 20 years, 16 years. If you haven't talked to Kevin, you might want to ask him.
Yep.
I think he might have been more involved with that at the time.
Okay. Well, and I'd say that I know that, you know, some of those statues and interpretive signs at Mile Zero have been put up, and I don't know if they were put up at the time of that celebration. I mean, I've interviewed
Lee. Well, the statues,
I don't believe.
No, the Mile Zero sign is one that we built, BLM built. We built one at Nome, and we built one for Seward. So we have Mile Zero and Mile 938, and we did those in our shop. And,
okay.
We had a carpentry shop there, and he produced those.
Right.
And I think the design on those.
But so that 100th anniversary wasn't a time when they installed some of those statues?
I don't recall ever seeing the statues.
Okay. There's a statue of one of the, prospector with the dog. And.
Okay, that might have been there. And then I think there was the Japanese musher.
Yeah.
I don't believe his statue was there at the time.
Yeah, but it is now. Okay, but it wasn't.
Right.
I didn't know if the anniversary was used as a reason for doing some of that.
Well, if it was, it must have been real short because it's extremely cold and miserable standing outside. So.
What time of year was it?
It was January, as I recall.
Okay.
January, February.
Okay. Yes, that would make it cold. And then. You talked a little bit about this, but maybe you could say a little bit more about the support or lack of support you had within BLM to do some of the trail projects you wanted to do and how those decisions got made.
Well, again, a lot of it goes back to the widget orientation of how funding comes down. And it was a new thing. It wasn't something that the agency had really been very heavily involved with, and as such, they didn't ascribe a great deal of importance to it. And I think that's where the events, particularly the most of the, at that time, I think that was mostly the Clinton administration, and many of the members of the advisory council were of a different party. So there was a little friction there between, you know, politically, which, you know, didn't help with how funding came down to Pike. You know, of course, you know, Senator Stevens was great. I mean, he did a tremendous amount of work in getting money funding for the trail, mm-hmm. and you know, Congressman Young too. But it was, you know, there wasn't a lot of other support from other entities.
And so within BLM, did you have to go through the chain of command and push for funding? And
no, absolutely.
And what?
Yeah, it was always a, you know, come with hat in hand and beg sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I really need some more work months. I need some dollars. These are the projects, and you know, you got an apportionment of, you know, whatever you might hope for. You might get a small percentage of it. It wasn't a matter of, well, we're going to do this, and this, fund it. No, it didn't happen. You know, you got pretty much what was left over.
And so were the other managers, well, I don't know if you went to your district manager and then state, I don't quite know how that
Well, it
works.
It went through the state office and eventually the Washington office.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any?
But it was the same thing with other programs. I mean, when I was a forester there, I was the only forester in Alaska and managed 22 million acres of forest lands. And got very, very little money for it.
Mm-hmm.
You could be the squeaky wheel, but sometimes you don't get any grease.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any particular allies or along the way through that chain that were helpful to you?
Eventually. I mean, eventually we had an actual staff in Washington that recognized some of the attributes. We had the director of BLM come out and visit. Kathleen Clark came out, and so there was a little bit. Toward the end, we started getting more funding,
mm-hmm.
and there was more recognition, and you know it went on from there. But it was a slow slog to get funding.
And did that include funding for the whole easements right-of-way portion?
Well, the easements and right-of-ways organization was through a lands group. They're basically land specialists. They were pretty well funded because that was a mandate. I mean, that was a congressional mandate to transfer lands. So they were funded for that process. But the ancillary parts of, you know, easements and rights of way recognition, those were came out of recommendations by everybody else. They were, I think a lot of people looked at those as an impediment to getting those accomplished. I mean, eventually they did. They did move toward getting the easements approved, but not it wasn't the biggest priority for the agency.
Mm-hmm. But again, the easements and right of way was sort of a different pot of money than what you were trying to do for
Correct.
Trail projects.
Well, that whole process of land transfer was through a different branch.
Okay. Did you have anybody in that branch that you worked with who was particularly helpful?
Well, we had our district realty lead was a woman named Sandy Dunn, and she was helpful. She helped us within her ability to influence the lands transaction.
What was her last name?
Dunn, D-U-N-N.
Okay. What about any obstacles or challenges besides obviously the funding one? Were there, other people who were difficult or?
Well, you know, I think once people understood what the trail was about, you know, they became more supportive. And I think a lot of them got tired of listening to me whine and complain and beg for money. So, you know, maybe if we give them some more money, it'll shut up. Kind of a thing. But, you know, I think a big part of it was trying to convince people that it was more than just a race.
Right. You know,
that there was an entity that had some value. And, you know, it was kind of a wake-up call for folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this can be a positive rather than a drain.
Right. And so you reported to an Anchorage field office or district manager?
Yeah, Well, at the time it was a district. It, you know, it's been through the iteration of district office and field office. But at the beginning when I worked there, there was a district, and my supervisor was a guy named Dick Burneman. He was the district manager.
Mm-hmm.
And he was supportive. He was supportive of the Iditarod. He was replaced a couple of times along the way, and I eventually ended up in this position when I retired.
Okay.
There was some that were better than others as far as seeing the validity or the veracity or the validity of the Iditarod as an entity.
Mm-hmm. And what's the difference between a field office and a district office?
Good question. At the time in the lower 48, you had a district office, which is equivalent to like the National Forest Supervisor's office, and then the field office would be the equivalent to like a ranger district in the Forest Service. In BLM, we had district offices, but we didn't have any field offices. We had at the time we had two or three district offices at Fairbanks. I think we had Arctic, Kobuk, and I can't recall what the third one was. We had a district office in Glen Ellen and a district office in Anchorage. And then when I retired, we had essentially two district offices. You had an Anchorage and a Fairbanks district mm-hmm. office.
Okay.
Glen Ellen was incorporated into Anchorage, and so was Norton, or the Nome office, which went to Anchorage. And then the rest of the state was in Fairbanks.
Okay, so BLM does not have field offices.
They do now. They're
oh.
called field offices. Yeah, I'm using the term district and field office sort of interchangeably now.
Okay.
But they're basically the administrative function is a combined district field office.
Okay, and so the district manager is the person in charge of that district office, and then they report to the state director.
There is a state director with his staff. Yeah, so he is the direct. He's supervised by the state director.
Okay. And so you said you switched to becoming the district manager.
I went from, this is an ongoing process, but I went from, I did a Iditarod Trail coordinator, recreation planner, to the district manager in Glen Ellen. That was the last district manager in Glen Ellen. That was incorporated as this is yet another term, a self-directed work team, which was later incorporated into the Anchorage office and became part of the Anchorage office. Then at that point, I went to the state office as the state forester. So I worked as a forester for the state, BLM in it as the state forester,
okay.
the only one. And then I went back to the field office as the field office manager, then as the associate director, Anchorage director, and then at that retirement, I became the field manager for Anchorage. That's what I retired at.
So you were the field manager in Anchorage,
right?
And when
which is basically the western half of Alaska.
Okay. And what year did you retire?
2008.
Okay. You also had mentioned on the phone another district manager, Gary Reimer.
Gary Reimer.
Reimer?
Yeah, he was in between. He was toward the end. I replaced Gary, and he went out to the state office.
And how was he as a manager in terms of supporting your work on the trail?
He was good. He did a good job.
Okay.
He was helpful. Both Dick Burneman and Gary have passed away, but they were, at the time when Gary was the manager, we were heavily involved with planning. We were doing a couple of land use plans, and that was a full-time job for a lot of people.
Right.
We did the Ring of Fire and the Bay management plans for that, for Anchorage.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't trail-related planning?
Other than the trail was a part, you know, was mentioned in the plan, but it was a land use plan for the area.
Okay. And in terms of, you know, you had talked before about the permitting and use of the trail, were there ever any times where there were conflicts over those permit requests and uses?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. You know, and early on, you know, there was always, there was a group of folks that saw non-motorized use as being, you know, what should happen because of the history of the All-Alaska sweepstakes and sled dog racing and sled dog use. But, you know, you really can't take away the motorized use because today there's a lot of traffic and snow machines between villages on the trail.
Right.
So, you know, there was some small amount of angst between the Iron Dog and the Iditarod on who got priority to use what, when, and how. And that, you know, eventually got worked out between them, and it came to a reasonable accommodation for both. Without either of them suffering too much in the process.
So did BLM sort of have to intervene and make some of those decisions since you were
timing and amount. So we did environmental assessments for both of them. At one point, the Iditarod was getting pretty popular, and we were getting concerns about the amount of use that could occur without causing damage. So we set limits on the number of sled dog teams and snow machines that could operate during that season. We never really reached that threshold, though. It never got to that level. But it came close a couple times.
I would say with the Iron Dog and the Iditarod sled dog race, did you guys have to intervene with their own internal conflicts, or they kind of figured it out?
No, we basically told them, hey, get your acts together, and, you don't want us to make the decisions on this one. And they did. They came to an accommodation.
Well, it makes sense. You know, all those snow machines going on the trail, that's great trail breaking.
Well, in some cases, but they can also cause damage, too, that makes it tougher on the dog teams.
Yeah, well, all the
when you come roaring down the Dalzell Gorge, it kind of, it can cause some issues with the subsequent users.
Yeah, I can see all the snow machines make it very bumpy in places, right?
Yeah, and there were some trail adjustments for a time we went through Ptarmigan Pass instead of going through the Dalzell. You know, went around the steep country with the snow machines. And, there was, now it doesn't seem like much of a deal, but at the time, there were some tempers that were flaring.
Mm-hmm.
We had some amusing requests for permits too that I thought were interesting. We had a case of one time when the group of Boy Scouts that wanted to run the Iditarod on snow machines from I think they went from Kinnick to Nome. I can't recall exactly, but it was it was well organized, and it was like a troop of Boy Scouts, and they had pre-positioned supplies, and they had a great time. It was wonderful, a wonderful trip for them. And a few weeks later, we got a call from the Special Forces group in Georgia. You know, the Green Berets. They wanted to ride snow machines on the Iditarod Trail, and I remember they had a big planning effort. They brought a couple of Green Beret Special Forces officers out to talk with us and pre-plan, and they had Chinook helicopters and unlimited supplies and gear and everything, and I remember one of them asking me, is it possible that we could do this? I said, oh sure, we just had a bunch of Boy Scouts do it, I suppose you guys could do it too. They didn't think that was too amusing, and they actually didn't finish. I think they got part of the way and they were pulled out, but we had a lot of entertaining things happen.
Were you guys responsible for rescue and pulling people off the trail?
No. They had, in that case, they had their own support with helicopters.
Mm-hmm. But what about like with the Boy Scouts?
Basically, we didn't have the capability to do that. And basically, that would have been the troopers who would have done rescues.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Summertime, if we had a fire organization in place, certainly would have helped.
Okay.
But during the winter, we really didn't have a presence. Now, one guy in Nome, one guy in Anchorage, not so much.
Right. Yeah, I'd never really, until you mentioned it, I never really thought about that, what happens if there's somebody out on the trail and they need help?
Well, basically, it's the troopers or, you know, whatever resources you could get from the nearest village.
Right.
You know, I just got to think that you might want to talk to somebody. I don't know if he's still there, but we hired a fella in Nome as our manager. Name is Tom Sparks. He may still be in Nome, and he may be worth talking to.
Okay, and what did he do?
Well, he was the BLM guy in Nome.
Okay.
He did a little bit of everything. He replaced Norm Messenger, who
okay.
I worked with.
Right.
And I think just before I retired, they might have, I think they hired Tom to work there in Nome.
Okay. Well, that's a good connection. Great. I was thinking other, so all the, any of the decisions about the trail use and the conflicts and permitting, that was all between you and Jake, or did it have to go up to the district manager at any time?
No, basically it was negotiated at the point of getting the permit. Now, the permit was signed by the district manager. I mean, I was a previously approving official on that.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, we'd usually worked all the conflicts out before it got to that level.
Okay. You've mentioned interpretation. How much interpretation can you do out there on the trail? Say, Mile Zero has stuff, but are there signs along the trail?
Right. There's a sign. We did a bunch of interpretive panels. They were, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 feet wide by about 8 feet tall. We had a graphic designer in our state office who did those. And she would find historic photos and blow them up. And then we'd put, you know, a typical interpretive type of a
right.
deal. And it was a backdrop display. And, you know, we'd do it at the Campbell Creek Science Center. During the race, during the restart, or not the restart, but the end of the ceremonial start. That's another thing that happened. Used to do they'd run the ceremonial start and then go to the VFW in Eagle River. Well, you know, they had some traffic conflicts, you know, on the Glen Highway, and the weather wasn't always good. A lot of times it'd be just glare ice, which is tough on a sled team. The Iditarod wanted an alternative, and Stan Hooley called one time and said, hey, you know, can we do it? Can we do the ceremonial start end somewhere else? And they wanted to do it at the Campbell Tract, which has a history of itself. It's
right.
It's an old World War II dispersal airfield, which is where we, you know, BLM has an office there.
Right.
And it had been a smoke jumper center at one time. Well, he wanted to go over and end it over there, and he said, yeah, let's do that. So that was we did a very abbreviated environmental assessment and process of getting that approved, and set up some interpretive displays at the Science Center, and organized shuttle buses to Parco. I think it was Abbott Loop Elementary. They'd bring tourists
right.
in to visit the site, and I think it's been pretty much there ever since.
Oh, okay.
And that was something that, you know, was kind of worked out well, because we could do interpretation with our displays there at the Science Center, and yet have a place for people to visit the Science Center and, you know, understand about it.
Right. And that Campbell Creek area, there used to be, you know, dog mushing races out of there.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of the
sure.
other side of the Campbell track from where the
right.
Science Center
right.
is.
Right. You're all through far north by Centennial Park, sure.
Yeah. So that makes sense. I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
changed.
I think the folks at the Eagle River didn't like it, because they got kind of aced out on their deal there. But it worked well, because, you know, they had plenty of parking there for the, you know, the mushers to bring their dog trucks. And
right.
there was water and, you know, a heated facility there if it was too cold. And it worked out well.
That's great. And so where else do you guys have interpretive exhibits?
Mostly at Nome during the end of the race. We occasionally would have one at the Iditarod Trail Committee headquarters, but that got to be really busy as far as traffic during the race, so it was kind of tried to stay away from there as much as possible, just for the traffic reasons.
Right.
You know, we did a whole series of posters and pamphlets over the years. We got Jeff Schultz, who was a photographer for, he was a professional. bought the rights to a number of his photos on the Iditarod, used those as posters. And I think if you can find some of those, they're kind of collector's items. Really, really nice posters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen some of them. Yeah, and we certainly have lots of the pamphlets and brochures and stuff that you guys produced.
But we did that, and I think when we brought them to Nome the first year, and, you know, the mushers would produce their own, you know, the winning mushers would produce their own posters, you know, the Iditarod champion posters. Right. And I remember talking to Martin Boozer one time, and he was kind of looking at his poster and looking at our poster, and kind of, I don't think he was too happy. I think we were giving our posters away, and they would bring them over to his table, have him sign them when he won, so... Anyway, it all worked out well, but I wish I still had a bunch of those. Those were one of our more popular products that we put out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't realize you guys had... I didn't realize that the racers put out their own posters.
Some of them did. I think Jeff King and Martin Boozer were the primary ones who did. Mm-hmm. Well, they were, you know, 4 or 5-time winners. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our posters would show up in a lot of places. I know they have the visitor center at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Hmm. There's a display on historic trails, and our posters are in there.
That's funny. Funny place for them. Mm-hmm. Given all the funding obstacles that you dealt with, were there things that you wish you could have done for the trail while you worked there that you were not able to accomplish?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of... We'd like to put up a lot more cabins, done a lot more signage and trail marking and improvements, and I mean, Kevin, I understand, has done some more cabins and has coordinated with the state to build cabins on state land. You know, those are all things that would have been nice to do at the time, but you know, it was a start.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had a particular pet project that you wish you had been able to do.
You mean other than the I did a cat race?
Yes.
No, I think the whole time I was there, it was more of a, you know, it's a keep it moving and hope for better times in the future. You know, it's more of a transitional period.
Mm-hmm. Are there any things that you feel were your big accomplishments during your time you're proud of?
Well, I think a lot of it was that it got recognition by people who, you know, only thought it was a race. And they came to the understanding that it was more than just that. Mm-hmm. And I think that right now it's right up there with the other National Historic Trails as far as recognition. And even though it was one of the first, it was not one of the best known.
Right.
I think now it is.
And I think this is just my feeling that trails in general are getting a lot more attention now than from the public. I'm not sure from the agencies, but public
sure.
are getting more attention, and that maybe helps as well.
Well, you know, at one time, you know, the Appalachian Trail and the Oregon Trail, and that was about it. You know, and the rest of it was, oh, there's a trail? You know, yeah, there's a lot of that. I think it's less and less of that now. I think that there's a lot, people see that there's a benefit, not only as from the recreational standpoint, but for, you know, the historical appreciation for what came before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as I say, nowadays, you know, hiking the Appalachian Trail or hiking the Pacific Crest Trail have become, you know, such popular activities, and you know, or the what's the one in the Colorado, Montana, isn't there one? Continental Divide Trail.
Continental Divide, yeah.
The
Florida Trail, for example, you know, I mean, there's one along the coast in Florida.
Oh, see, I didn't know that one. And now there's a push for what's called the Long Trail in Alaska.
Right.
People are starting to recognize that there is an interest in this kind of thing.
Well, you know, the initial management plan was Gold Rush Trails in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of the whole incentive for the Iditarod. Well, of course, you know, the Alaska sweepstakes, but it took in everything. The mail trail, the Seward and Nome mail trail, you know, the Iditarod Gold Rush, you know, the diphtheria run.
Right.
You know, all of those were issues that kind of tied into the parts of the Iditarod, although were not necessarily the focus of the Iditarod.
Right. Well, that Serum Run, that Norm Vaughn's recreation of the Serum Run, did that involve the Iditarod Trail?
Yeah, it took place on parts of it.
And so
from Caltech, you know, the Clayton, and at the coast, yeah.
Yeah, but so were you guys involved in that, or You said you permitted it, I guess.
Yeah, Norman was a kind of a, how can I put it, a, I will say a maverick. He had a vision on how he wanted things to go. And I can't remember. I think we probably permitted it, but I'm not sure.
Well, he did the run, so if you...
Oh, he definitely did the run. I was in Nome when he finished it.
Right.
But I don't recall whether we did issue him a permit for it.
And so if you did not, he ran it anyway. And...
Yeah, oh yeah. And I don't know that it was so much of a commercial enterprise, although he had people, you know, that took part in him. I don't know whether he charged them for his services as a guide. I can't recall at this time what the issues were, but... I know that when, well, this is, when he arrived in Nome, this was during the end of the Iditarod, and I remember he set up his table, you know, at the visitor center at the end of the race in Nome, each of the mushers would have a table where they would sign autographs. And, you know, they would usually take one of our posters and go to each of the tables and have the mushers sign their poster. And I remember Norman came in and he set up, I believe it was Martin Boozer who was the winner that year. And he came over and he sat down at Martin Boozer's table so he could sign autographs, which I never did ask Martin how he felt about that, but it was an interesting time.
Yes, well, and say, Norman Vaughn was not somebody who you would say, could you go leave my table, please?
He had a certain style, if you will.
Well, yeah, he was a larger-than-life character, so people would not confront that, I think.
I think that's part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Although, you know, he wasn't allowed to finish. Well, you'd have to talk to the Iditarod Trail Committee on his history of running the race.
Yeah, but, I don't think he actually ran the race, did he?
He tried. I think he dropped out a couple times.
Yeah. But I guess the other thing in terms of other challenges that you had while doing this work with BLM that you might want to talk about, or things that maybe you wish you could have done differently or could have been done differently.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it goes back to the available time and the available money. You know, if you only have 1 or 2 months out of the year to spend on it, it's tough to develop a sense of continuity. And you know, you get those things that you can get with the money you have, and that again is not a particularly good way to manage something long term.
Right.
But as time went on, it got better and better, and you know, now apparently that you know, there's a full time position that's funded, and you know, a line item in the budget. So that's something I wish we had had then. Because there was no lack of projects, no lack of things that could have been done.
Right. I did want to ask you about the people in the villages and the communities, that how you guys maybe interacted with them. Did they help with trail brushing, with building cabins?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, obviously the places where there was, you know, larger communities, you got a lot more activity. Seward, for example, you have the Trailblazer chapter there. It did phenomenal work. You know, they worked primarily with Forest Service because of the proximity to the Chugach. But Knick had a Trailblazers group. Folks in McGrath, in Nikolai, in Unalakleet, Chektulik, Nome. I don't recall working with folks in Caltag, although it probably happened, but no, we had meetings with most of the villages the trail went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at certain times. A lot of it was during the summer and related to other activities. I know that I did a lot of fire work. So I spent a lot of time in McGrath during fire season, you know, a lot of time talking about the Iditarod, you know, when we're involved with fires. You know, same thing in Unalakleet. You know, a lot of the local folks, a lot of the businesses, you know, would get, you know, a lot of their revenue during the time Iditarod, especially... you know, in Unalakleet and some of the other villages that they depended on. And that was one of the reasons why you had a northern and southern route for the race, to be able to spread the wealth of the fact that the trail was bringing use and spending dollars in their communities.
That makes sense. And what about in so did people, you know, like in McGrath or in Ruby or wherever, did they go out and maintain their section of the trail by brushing it and
Well, you got to remember, a lot of that trail was used anyway for, right, for travel between villages. So, yeah, absolutely. I don't recall that there was an actual group of trailblazers, per se, in McGrath or Ruby, but a lot of the local folks, you know, would work with the Iditarod Trail Committee and with us to, well, you know, what needs to get done? Well, could you use you to brush that trail or put up some, you know, we'd hand out reflectors and markers and signage and help where we could as far as providing things like, you know, some materials and some tools.
Okay.
But it was not an organized chapter per se that you had, okay, we're going to have 25 people out here for 2 weeks, you know, running this trail. It didn't happen like that. It was
right.
More, you know, as available.
Okay.
And,
yeah,
you know, there were a lot of people that ran their trap line out there.
Yeah.
So they kept the trail up for that purpose.
Okay.
And
yes.
They maintained the cabins as well.
Oh, okay.
I mean, folks from McGrath would come out and maintain the Bear Creek cabin. You know, some of them would go as far as Roan. You know, we spent 1 year totally rebuilding the Roan cabin. That was another task that was real entertaining. Because it was National Register eligible, we ended up reconstructing the cabin from the ground up using a lot of the original logs, and you know, the roof on the cabin was sod, but underneath the sod was flattened gas cans from when they used to run aviation gas in 5 gallon square or rectangular cans. They would flatten the cans out, and those were the shingles on the roof there. So when we rebuilt it, we had to fabricate similar type of roof shingles from sheet metal to appear as if they were the original Blazo cans. So that was all a total reconstruction project, which we did. So
you didn't go out and reuse old Blazo cans?
They were almost impossible to find.
Yeah.
We did have some. I mean, you've got a lot of the cabins, you've got shelves and furniture that's made from old Blazo boxes.
Right.
Because the cans, you know, they came to a box. And I know the Roan cabin, the shelves on the walls are Blazo boxes.
Right.
But bears got into it and porcupines got into it and destroyed a lot of it, so we had to go back and totally rebuild it.
Okay. But you did... Yeah, and so, like, in that case, did you hire people in the area?
Nope.
Was anybody...
Nope, there was really no run around our own.
Okay.
So far away. We had our own staff, Jake, and Ken Higgins was a carpenter. Jake and Ken and a few other folks went out and spent a week or two out there rebuilding the entire cabin, put a new roof on it, and new sill logs. So it was from the bottom up and the top down.
Yeah, so there wasn't a historic architect or... historic restoration specialist?
We did have our archaeologist survey it.
Mm-hmm.
She did a lot of the preliminary work on it.
Yeah, I was thinking that, like in Seward, you know, for Klondike, they have all these specialty carpenters who knew how to rebuild old buildings, and didn't know if you guys had used anybody like that.
We had some pretty good carpenters, actually. The same people that built the Tripod Flats cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And I would challenge people to look at Roan and say that it wasn't the same cabin.
So has it become a National Register site?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think it was eligible, but I don't know if it was ever run through the process.
And then some of those places, like Rainy Pass, or there's a lodge. There are some people who live out along there that are not in the villages, correct?
That's true. Yeah, there are some lodges. Rainy Pass, yeah.
And you guys coordinate with them as well?
Sure, yeah. Is Rainy Pass still operating?
I don't know.
You know the history of Rainy Pass and how the Roan cabin got there.
No, I do not.
Well, when aircraft became, you know, when Ben Eielson did his flight to McGrath from Fairbanks, I think it was 1925 or somewhere around there.
Yeah, that sounds right.
A lot of the traffic from Anchorage into the interior went over Rainy Pass. So Rainy Pass is oftentimes weathered in. It's a very dangerous pass because I don't know if you've ever flown in the country. If you're not familiar with the area, you'll follow that pass, and it'll take you right into a mountain. You know, the most obvious looking pass is not the correct one. So there are a lot of airplane crashes, and there are a lot of wrecks up there. And there, on a clear day, you can see a lot of them. But anyhow, they built, I think it was, I want to say the WPA, might have been the CCC in the 30s, built an airstrip at Roan. It's right on the other side of the pass, on the inland, or on the McGrath side of the pass, so that people waiting for weather could wait it out there. You know, if the weather wasn't good enough to get through the pass, they could land there and wait at the cabin. And so that cabin was initially used as a point for aircraft. So about every famous early bush pilot in Alaska stayed there, you know, at one time or another.
Wow.
And there's quite a history on the cabin, and that's why it's there. So that became used as a checkpoint for the Iditarod because it had an airstrip associated with it.
Right.
And it was convenient. It was a good place to rest your dogs, and you know, it was in the trees, so it was protected from the wind, and had water available from the Kuskokwim. So it kind of morphed into use for the Iditarod, but it actually started as a location for aviation safety.
Oh, okay. Well, great. Thanks.
It's worth a book by itself.
I'm sure. That's why it's eligible for National Register.
Sure. Yep.
And you've talked a little bit about some of your experiences out on the trail. How much time were you able to spend out there?
Well, every summer I'd spend some time out there, and quite often in the winter as well. But, time was limited for a lot of it. A lot of it was more bureaucracy related than actual on the trail work. But, put up lots of tripods, lots of signs, did a fair amount of cabin building. Got lots of mosquito bites, and it was an interesting time to be there.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, let's just say that if I ever see another bottle of DEET insect repellent, it'll be too soon. we did a project one time to do aerial photos, and it was mostly Western Alaska, not so much only the Iditarod, but in order to do that, you have to put out markers, visible markers from an aircraft. So you put out big white plastic panels, vinyl that you stake out there, and then when the air photo is done, they can correlate it, because they're known distance apart, so they can correlate the photos. And we did that out of Caltech and Unalakleet on that portion of the trail. And the mosquitoes were so thick that you'd land in a helicopter and the rotor wash would, keep the mosquitoes at bay under the arc of the rotor. You get outside of that and you just practically be carried away by the mosquitoes. I can remember slapping my leg at mosquitoes, and I think I killed like 18 mosquitoes with one slap. It was brutal. I mean, it was, I could see where, a lot of the pilots I knew, they would put, in their survival kit, the first thing they'd put in there would be a head net,
right.
And then the next thing would be mosquito repellent, and then they'd start worrying about things like fire starters and food and things like that.
I thought you were going to say the first thing they put in there would be a pistol to kill themselves so they didn't have, because the mosquitoes were so bad.
I'm sure there were some people that thought about that. That kind of brings up another thought of some of the people, and it's kind of related as far as the flying. One of the guys that we did some work with was a guy named Don Bowers. And Don was the chief pilot of the Iditarod Air Force at the time. He would fly supplies in during the race, and he always wanted to be a musher. He always wanted to run dogs. But, he didn't own dogs, so he followed the race for years as the Iditarod pilot. And then he got an opportunity to borrow some dogs, and he raced a couple times, and he managed to actually win, or not win, but he actually finished the race, which, it's a phenomenal achievement. More people have stood on the summit of Mount Everest that have passed under the Burled Arch in Nome, after finishing the race. And he wrote a book called Back of the Pack,
mm-hmm.
and guidebook for the trail for mushers. You know, at this point, take this branch, follow this trail up to here, and at that river turn, you know, it was a, you know, a point-to-point trail guide. But unfortunately, he was killed in a plane crash. He was flying some Park Service rangers up to Denali and plane crashed. But we were helping him edit that, and I don't believe it ever got done. It ever was finished.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that would have been, you know, a great use for people, you know, to, at least from the aspect of how to find the trail in places where it wasn't very apparent.
Yeah, well, yeah, so did you guys, in those places that aren't apparent, were those targeted places for markers for you guys?
Yeah, yeah, where we, and you know, it, when you fly out, a lot of times you can see it. You know, you'll see if nothing more than a bunch of broken tripods and reflectors shining on the trail, and you can see where the use occurs.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when you had 20 or 30 trails side by side that were a little bit difficult to identify, which was the most historically accurate, if you will. Although they all went to the same, pretty much the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I
go ahead.
No, I'm. Go ahead. I was. I didn't really have anything to carry on from that.
No, I was going to say that I think I read someplace online, that maybe it's through the Trail Committee website or something, or the trail itself website, that it looked kind of like a blog sort of thing, like this section of the trail, you do this and you do that, that there might be some equivalent of his guidebook kind of out there.
Yeah. Yeah, he, again, I'm not sure whatever became of it. I know that we edited a couple of chapters of it. He came over and we sat down at length and you know, went over the management plan and what we knew from our travels on the trail, where things were.
Mm-hmm.
But his guidebook was essentially for the musher,
right?
You know, because the mushers couldn't use a GPS. They weren't allowed to do that. So they were relying on, you know, experience and whatever trail markers were out there.
Yeah.
And Don was pretty adept at the navigation part of it.
Cool. So what did your time working with the trail, what has that meant to you, whether personally or professionally?
Well, again, go back to connections. It was amazing to me the number of people I would never have been able to meet otherwise or to interact with. And, you know, I'm, like I said, every governor from Jay Hammond to Sarah Palin, except for Steve Cooper, you know, either worked with directly or indirectly or had a contact with them on an issue, and it always got around to the Iditarod. Hey, your job is the best one there is. I wish I had your job. And I'm going, are you sure? You know? So it made for some interesting, same thing, every mayor of Anchorage that during the time I was there, you know, meet with them regularly. You know, Joe Reddington, Joe and his wife Vi, they were phenomenal people. People that, you know, they're legendary, but you get to know them on a personal level. You know, Leo Rasmussen, Dan Seavey, Judy Bittner, all of those folks are you know, they need to be taken advantage of while they're alive, because they're a repository of knowledge and experience that you're not going to see again.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, was one of the biggest parts of the, you know, the benefits of working on the trail, was the people that you met and interacted with.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so why is it that you ended up leaving the position? And
I got old. No, it was a matter of, you know, other tasks, other opportunities. You know, but I still stayed in Alaska.
Right.
And, you know, I still had some peripheral activities associated with the Iditarod. I probably would not have been at the 2008 centennial if I hadn't already been involved with the Iditarod.
Right.
Earlier.
So you had the desire to go back to forestry. Was that part of it?
Well, it was like, okay, there's dollars in work months associated with this program, and we can't afford the person, and you have the background, knowledge, abilities, and degree to do this, so why don't you do it? So that's kind of where it ended up.
Okay. Yeah.
To this day, I think there's only one forester in Alaska. Who actually was a classmate of mine, if he's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, we forestry, BLM, we don't associate those things together. Forestry, we associate it with the Forest Service.
Well, if you go to the Western Oregon, you're going to see a lot of BLM forest lands.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. And, you know, BLM is known for cows, mining, and grazing.
Right.
So that's the big thing. But there is certainly timber management.
Oh, yeah, certainly there is. I just say we just... In Alaska, we don't associate it with BLM, so that's that's probably why there's only one forester.
Well, like I said earlier, there's 22 million acres of forest lands in Alaska, which is the largest forest
right.
land amount in the U.S. for one entity. The problem is that there's not a lot of structure as far as outside of Southeast Alaska where there's facilities to operate. Yeah,
right.
In South Central. In the Kenai Peninsula, yeah, there's some logging that takes place there. But the big thing was forest health, and that
right.
dealt with fire management and with insects.
Right.
That was a push at one time. There was a spruce bark beetle epidemic
right.
that it was a big deal when Murkowski was governor.
Right.
And, we had to, as I was a part of that group that worked on forest health on the Kenai.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there, you know, as the issues arise, you know, you take the plug and put it in the hole in the dike kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, so you'd mentioned it before, and I forgot to follow up on it, that in terms of fire management, was the Iditarod Trail threatened by forest fires at any point? Is that an issue to be considered?
Well, not so much as it was threatened as that a lot of the areas that burned, obviously. The Farewell Burn was a huge fire. I think it was, 1976 that burned 800-plus thousand acres. And, you know, trail goes right through it. So, yeah, that affected, you know, access, hence my, you know, joke about the Iditarod cat. There's a lot of down trees across it that would have probably benefited from some form of trail breaking with the machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's improved quite a bit. I know that in, I'm trying to remember the year, probably the mid-90s, you know, we had a million-plus acre fire through central Alaska, a bunch of McGrath and the area as far as Caltag and Ruby and that area, much of it burned. We did a flight, a perimeter flight in a twin engine aircraft, and we couldn't cover it in one day.
Wow.
So it was a big fire.
Yeah.
And that's a common occurrence during the summer. But the thing is, you're not going to really hurt the trail so much. You know, you might cause trees to fall across it, but trail's still there.
Okay.
You know, and you might have to replace some facilities or improvements. But generally, in most cases, I can recall one time the fire, I don't remember which cabin it was, but we had smoke jumpers go in and, cover it with, we called them roasting bags, aluminum foil,
mm-hmm.
and set up a sprinkler system to prevent it from burning. So, yeah, if we can get to it, there are facilities that are identified for protection. You know,
mm-hmm.
we do go out and protect them. I think the biggest issue we had with fire on the Iditarod is I think one of the mushers, after we built the Bear Creek fire, was drying their clothes inside the cabin, hanging in from an internal clothesline. Their clothes caught fire inside the cabin. And I think a musher came in, saw the smoke, and was able to get the musher out before they succumbed to the smoke, but it didn't burn down the cabin, but I guess it was a close thing. That would have ruined their whole day.
Yeah, and burning down one of those cabins would not be a good thing.
Well, and that was another thing that was kind of an issue at the time. I know that the advisory council, Joe Reddington was big about we need to get more shelter cabins. Going mm-hmm. back to the history of the the roadhouses 20 miles apart, and we built the first one, the Bear Creek cabin, and it was expensive. You know, the cost of the aircraft and the materials and the salaries to build it was, I think, was somewhere in the neighborhood by the time we got done of close to $100,000 for a cabin.
Yeah.
And that was a huge sum, and I don't believe that there was any way you could have done it cheaper. You know, I mean, sure, you could have done a stick-built, T-111-sided storage shed kind of a deal, but first barrel to walk through would have knocked it down. But, that was a question about, well, that wasn't co- cost effective. Well, you know, what are the alternatives? You know, that would have been nice to have been able to, you know, have local folks in the villages do them, but, you know, the big cost was getting the materials there. But over time, it, you know, that whole issue improved. So
yeah.
People came to the realization that it wasn't a quick and easy fix.
Yeah, and I think now they have used some local hire villagers to help build some of the newer
sure.
cabins.
Sure, where there's an opportunity, yeah, absolutely.
So that
didn't they do something over by Ruby or Golovin or somewhere over there? I can't recall.
I think somewhere by Golovin there's one, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't remember the names of them, but from what Judy told me, yeah.
Right. I think we did we did some work on the safety cabin. Mm-hmm. Although it was not, you know, that's Sikmasok or Bering Straits corporate land.
Right.
But I think we threw some dollars into doing some help with that as far as materials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it sounds like most of your limited funding was spent on cabin work. Would you say that?
Yeah, cabin and trail marking.
Right.
You know, a lot of signage.
All right. Anything else that I haven't asked you about that you recall from those times?
I think you probably worked through my memory banks here to the point I'm not sure that I can have much left to offer. You know, the other thing is that I'm really encouraged with the you know, the educational aspects that are coming out of the Iditarod. I guess it's now being taught in schools in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
More thoroughly than it was in my day, and I think that's important to keep the history alive. Otherwise, you know, it's going to die. It's going to fall away. And I think it's worthy of, at least from the residents of the state, to know what their history is.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly have found from this project, learning the history, that there was a Gold Rush Trail and how it was used originally, that it wasn't just made up for a dog sled race.
No, yeah. Well, all those side and connecting trails are, what, 2,400 miles or so of side connecting and main trails. And there's race routes. Yeah, it's kind of a bowl of spaghetti out there.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Most, even now, I think most Alaskans don't know that.
No, yeah. Everybody says, well, what about Balto and the Sherman? Well, yeah, that wasn't exactly why it was there. It has part of it, but it's not the whole thing.
Right. And
that's kind of the end of the trail, if you will. I mean, that and the airplane.
Yeah, well, and also I think that how much historically there were all these trails and how much time people spent out on the land and navigating and knowing these areas, that now everybody just flies over.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if you fly low enough, you're still going to see it. Or even from altitude, you can see it. I ridden a 737 from Anchorage to Nome and looked down and seen the Iditarod Trail from 30,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think people don't have those same connections to
sure.
these trails and the land, and you know, to think that the town of Iditarod out there in nowadays is the middle of nowhere. There were thousands of people living there at one point.
Oh yeah, they had an electric power plant, a bottling plant, and yeah, I mean it was a going concern.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, the Dexter Roadhouse in Nome on the trail. That was Wyatt Earp's saloon, and,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of history there that people just are. Little tidbits that are really interesting that they don't know about that probably are deserving of some more effort or interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just how places and landscapes change with the times.
Right. Yep, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and when did you leave Alaska? Because you retired in 2008, but...
I left the summer of 2008 in June.
Okay. And why did you choose Idaho?
Well, it's a good question. Well, it had four seasons, but it wasn't two seasons of winter and road construction,
right?
Like it is in much of Alaska. You know, I originally, when I went to college in Missoula, I spent a lot of time driving from the Intermountain West to the coast, and one of the first stops on the way to the coast was you know, a little town of Coeur d'Alene. Beautiful lakes, lots of trees, friendly people, and I thought, you know, I kind of like that place. Maybe I'll spend more time there someday. Well, someday came when I retired.
Well, that's great. Yeah. I do appreciate your time today. I know it's a long time to have a phone up to your ear. So I'm going to turn off the recorder, but don't go away because I have something else to say.
All right, Karen. Well, I appreciate the time you spent and the efforts you're making in, on behalf of this project. I think it's well worth your time and efforts.
Well, I appreciate all your time today, too, and pulling up those old memories.
Well, a few of them that resonate, you know, it's like they say, the synapses sometimes snap open, but often they don't snap back.
Okay, well, hold on a second.